All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, speaking to you from New York City on the 5th day of November, 2019. I do want to thank each of you for listening to this show, making it one of the more popular shows in the Voice America Business Channel. And I also want to encourage you to continue your comments and whatever you have to say about this show, if you'd like to share them with us, send it along to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. Questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. I also want to thank our sponsors for making this show economically viable. And I want to welcome two new sponsors this week, Gatling Explorations, Inc. and TriStar Gold Resources. Gatling Explorations is in the process of expanding a nearly 1 million ounce deposit in Ontario with Dale Ginn as the lead geologist. It is my firm belief the prospects for a high-margin, multi-million-ounce gold deposit is very much in the possibility, within the realm of possibility, and that's why I've added Gatling to my newsletter and have purchased shares of the stock for my own account as well. Gatling's CEO is expected to be on this show to talk more about his company's prospects on the November 26th show. And then there's TriStar Gold. It's developing an advanced-stage gold project and Parastate, Brazil, where it has 2 million ounces of high-grade gold in an open-pit situation. A recent economic study of that company's gold project calculated a 5% discounted net present value at $1,250 gold of $264 million. Well, that compares to the company's current market cap of $25 million. So TriStar seems to me to be very undervalued, which is why I've added coverage on that stock as well to my newsletter, Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. And next Tuesday, Nick Appleyard, the CEO of TriStar, will be with me to tell you more about TriStar's prospects in Brazil as they move forward. By the way, both TriStar and Gatling will be joining me at the Metals Investor Forum in Vancouver on November 15th and 16th. And I would just like to suggest that if you're in the Vancouver area on those days, you can attend. It's free of charge, and you get a free breakfast and a lunch and cocktails at the end of the two-day sessions. Simply go to J. Taylor Media, J-A-Y Taylor Media, click on the banner and enter your name and email, and you will be assured of a position and a seat at the conference. Let me also not forget the three other existing sponsors to on this show, namely Great Bear, Novo Resources, and Irving Resources. In fact, Irving Resources put out some very positive drill results this morning from its gold exploration project in Japan. The stock has responded with a gain of around 20% today on this news, so I'm really excited to tell you that Dr. Quentin Henning will be with me right after the first commercial break to help us understand the significance of the high-grade gold results announced by Irving this morning. And I would suggest investors should also keep their eyes on Novo Resources, another Quentin Henning company. While the stock is down a bit today, I believe there may be some very significant news for Novo, given the fact that Dr. Henning has requested to come on this show to talk about Novo on November 19th. He's going to apparently believe he'll have some news and some information by that time. He usually tries to schedule his appearances on this show to coincide with news events, and I believe that he probably thinks he's got something significant coming your way, so you might want to make sure you listen to Dr. Henning on November 19th. Should also perhaps comment on the weakness of Great Bear's share price. From what I can discern, it is largely related to the sale of flow-through shares by Canadian investors. there may be something like 2 million flow-through shares that are coming onto the market now, which is quite a bit for this small-cap company. And due to tax breaks, you should realize that the Canadian investors, it's advantageous for them. They pay a bit more for the shares, but they get huge tax breaks. That helps the companies because the companies raise more money with less share dilution. But then what happens is the people find it advantageous to sell their shares rather quickly a lot of times, and that can create some real price weakness. Well, I'm looking at this not as as something that's not – I kind of expected it, realizing that these were going to come onto the market. So I told my subscribers that I was selling some of mine in preparation for this, but I'm really looking for this as a buying opportunity once these shares find their bottom after this selling is over with. So there's a lot going on in the junior share markets. It's a very exciting time. Today is a downer for gold investors for sure, but longer term, I don't think there's anything to worry about. We'll be talking to Michael Oliver a little bit, and we'll find out what he thinks about that. I've titled today's show, Monetary Failure is Becoming Inevitable. Alistair MacLeod, Michael Oliver, and Quentin Henning join me today. The title of today's show was taken from a recent article written by Alistair MacLeod, who will be with me during the second hour of today's show. He previewed, in previewing the article, I would just like to pass along a couple of his comments. Here's what he said in giving an overview of the article that he wrote on October 10th. He said, and I quote, "An unpleasant conjunction of events is beginning to undermine government finances in more developed nations, including the arrival of a long-term trend of rising welfare commitments with an increasing certainty of a global-scale credit crisis. Those problems are, in turn, the outcome of a combination of the peak of the credit cycle and increasing trade protectionism. Few observers seem aware that an economic and systemic crisis will occur at the same time as government finances are already precarious. However, the consequences are unthinkable for the authorities, and for this reason, it is certain such a downturn will lead to a substantial increase in monetary inflation." End of quote. Well, as I said, we'll hear more from Alistair on the underlying dynamics as to why a monetary failure is inevitable. And as I noted a minute ago, Dr. Quentin Henning will be with me to talk about Irving Resources right after our first commercial break. But right now, I'm really happy to tell you Michael Oliver is with me once again to try to calm our nerves on a day when gold is getting slammed rather hard. Thanks for joining me again, Michael.
Hi, Jay. Good to be back.
It's really always good to have you here, and I should remind our listeners once again, it's olivermsa.com, olivermsa.com, to learn more about Michael's work and hopefully to sign up for his letter because it presents really great value. At least I'm finding that to be the case. I should mention before we get started with Michael that due to demands on his time, he will be joining me every other week from now on. I'm sorry that we won't hear from him on a weekly basis, but I do like to respect his time, and I would like to remind our listeners that if they truly want to profit from Michael's advice and the many markets that he covers, besides those that we talk about on this show, they should go to olivermsa.com, sign up for his letter. If you're a serious investor, I think you'll find it very well worth your while. What I find Michael to be, from my perspective, is a force of stability in a time when things seem to be very increasingly chaotic. And so that's very, very helpful to me. Michael, I'm really thankful for the time you've given us, and I appreciate any time you can spare. I know that our listeners love to hear from you, really appreciate that you could be with me again. I want to ask you, recently you said that for gold to make its new moves, its next moves higher, and you sort of target a $1,700 price ceiling for the next major move, you think we need to see some directional changes in a couple of other markets, namely for the dollar to head lower and or commodities in general to take off to the upside. How are those two markets behaving now as we've entered into the month of November?
Well, if you go back about early October, in the dollar index, cash dollar index, it was trading above 99, up in 99.5 area. It's since dropped to 97 area. Right now it's having a rally back to the upper 97s today, but it's dropped down toward levels that are dangerous for it, technically speaking, using our work, momentum structure. It actually closed last week below one of our key numbers, but while that's probably a hint, we prefer a monthly close down in that low 97 area. But the main point is it's moved in that direction, which I don't think a lot of people expected. Now, simultaneous with that is another major asset category that, again, nobody's watching because it's been quiet for so long, and there's so many assumptions that it'll stay forever quiet, and that's the commodity complex, excluding gold and silver now. I'm talking about everything else, crude oil, copper, platinum, which is not a monetary metal, by the way, the grains, the soft commodities, and so forth. They're waking up. And we've engaged some numbers today on the Bloomberg Commodity Index that hint to us essentially what the dollar hinted the other way last week, namely it's moving in the right direction, in this case, upside. The Bloomberg looks like it's a potentially very explosive situation, and it's I'm seeing it across the board in the commodity complex. It's not limited to crude oil or something like that. It's even copper in a weak economic world has been moving up sharply in the last three or four weeks with no particular good reason, if you know what I mean. I think the reason is what your guest later on the show mentioned, that is namely monetary. Now, we know when the central banks create massive flows or rivers of money, primarily to defend their stock markets and their debt markets, it doesn't always go where they want it to go. It did in 2009 through recently. It went into the stock markets of the developed world.
Yeah, they like that.
And that's where investors had fun. So they put it there. It worked. You know, it felt good. It really hasn't felt that good over the last year, year and a half. S&P's up, beating its chest and everything, but if you look at the percent gains it's had since January 2018 or since September of 2018, you're talking narrow single percent gains with a lot of huffing and puffing.
Yeah.
That money has moved into other markets. Gold is obviously one of them. T-bonds was another one, so that's a waning issue. And I think the commodity complex is where the major injection is going to occur, where the investors say, okay, enough. It's not going down anymore. It has a very low risk. It's proven itself as based out, and it's only one way to go. And I think that money is going to flow into commodities, which will be a second wind at the back of gold at that point, a validation of what gold's already said. So that's where I'd be looking right now with intense focus, is on the area that nobody's looking at, the commodity complex. Because if that comes undone on the upside, and I think it could surge 30% rapidly once it clears some breakout levels, that's going to upset all kinds of market assumptions, stock market assumptions, debt market assumptions, and so forth. And it'll be a nice ambush.
Well, here's what I like to take the work that you have from your perspective at MSA, the objective work that you have. And then I piece that together with people like Alistair McLeod, who's going to be on later today. And Alistair gave us a working framework, a framework, if you will, that can explain why interest rates could actually start going up in this market, which nobody's expecting either. Everybody's expecting they're going to go down negative and so forth, even in the U.S. But he points out that at some point in time, as rates go down, the dollar becomes less attractive. People sell the dollars and start buying stuff, commodities, if you will. You know, they started, as you say, that process has already started. He points out the dollar doesn't have to go negative for that to happen, but when it goes down to a certain level below the time preference for other commodities, for other, for gold and silver and so forth, we know we can get 1.5 or 2% in the forward market in gold. The lease, that's the lease rate, so that's sort of a time preference value for gold. Well, interest rates are below that now in many cases, even in the U.S., so not higher than that anyway in most cases, for at least for treasuries and so forth. So that's interesting to me, Michael. So you, what are your charts telling is telling you about the T-bonds, though? I know that's the market you watch.
That's a big if. We got bullish on T-bonds, meaning lower yields, back last December. T-bond futures were 141. They surged up to near 170 recently, and now they're in the high 150s, and they're playing with areas where they while they held it last month on the close, enough for us to say, okay, the damage wasn't done, but they certainly tested levels that are critical. Now they're they had a rally late last week or early this month, and they're giving it back up. So we think that the debt market, the government debt market, which has been pursued by investors much like they pursued gold, could separate and head back down now, and the synchronization between bonds and stocks will be the same. Lower prices in bonds, meaning higher yields, will coincide with lower prices in stocks. I have a gut assumption. It's a conclusion my son and I came up with, who's a technician with MSA, recently, and that is that while the stock market might top here, and other markets might change their trends as well, such as the Bloomberg Commodity Index to the upside and so forth, the real bloodletting in the stock market is not likely to show itself until next quarter. Our trigger numbers on the stock market right now are massive and very clear. In fact, they're the clearest I've ever seen in a century of looking at going back and studying our metrics applied against past markets. But I think they won't be engaged until next quarter. And part of the reason is that usually when our structures break on momentum, they occur at levels that don't make much sense on price charts. Right now, if we broke through most of our major structures, it would make some sense on some price charts that, oh, it's breaking down. I think what's going to happen is our numbers will adjust up sharply in 30-some-odd trading days when we get into the first quarter of next year and the new annual numbers occur as well, such that when we trigger our structures to the downside, it'll be in that time frame, not now. We might maneuver our way toward those numbers between now and January, but not enough to where it creates any panic. So we think that while you may top the stock market at any point here, you're not going to see any bloodletting until we get into early next year. And I think that's when the real compression, the unleashing will occur.
All right. And
anyway, so it should be exciting, but it might be delayed.
All right. Well, thank you, Michael. Thank you very much. We're out of time. Thank you for that insight and connecting these markets together, the interplay. Very fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll look to talk to you in a couple of weeks from now.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Well, that's all the time we have for this segment. We're going to be right back with Quentin Henning. He's going to talk about Irving Resources, which has had quite a day today. It's up some 20%, at least earlier today. I haven't checked in the last hour or so. Very, very exciting story. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Quentin Henning.
Noble Resources Corp. trades on the OTCQX under the symbol NSRPF and on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol NVO. Its flagship assets are located in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. Novo has recently partnered with Sumitomo Corporation of Japan to evaluate, advance, and develop the company's Australian gold projects. With over $40 million in cash and $60 million committed from Sumitomo, Novo is well on its way to establishing itself as one of the top junior explorers and developers in Australia.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really pleased to have Dr. Quentin Henning with me once again. Well, most of you know him, Dr. Henning, for his ongoing success at Novo Resources, his exploration success there. But he is also a director and an independent geologist, and a geologist that's really helping to guide the exploration program for Irving Resources in Japan. So we're really pleased to have Dr. Henning with us again today. I should mention before we say hello to Quentin that Irving trades in Canada under the symbol IRV. You can buy it in the U.S. as I have under the symbol IRVRF. Just a little under 50 million shares outstanding, and the stock is up strongly today at $2.08. In fact, as I'm looking at the screen now, it's up about 20% on the day on some really exciting news. So it's really great to have Quentin with me today at a time when obviously people are paying attention, a lot of attention to Irving Resources. Thanks for joining me again, Quentin.
Absolutely, Jay.
really good to have you. As I say, the stock is up really big today on the assays from your OMU, from the OMU Gold Project in Hokkaido, Japan. And as I say, the market has really responded really, really nicely. What can you tell us? What can you tell investors that they should take away from the announcement today, from the press release, which showed several intersections of very significant grades of gold?
Yeah, the news release covers a number of things, but the main focus is on the drill results that we have from what we call the OMU Center target. To give a flavor for what this is, it's a target. It's basically an area, a geological area that we identified about 3 years ago through doing prospecting. What drew us into there, believe it or not, okay, were very large boulders of a rock called Sinter. Sinter is layered laminated silica that forms in hot spring pools. Hot spring pools are, you know, what sit above some of these high-grade epithermal vein deposits. You know, they're basically the surface expression. Okay, so when we were working at OMU Town, which is a little fishing village on the coast, we noticed a lot of people had these big rocks in their garden. We inquired where were people sourcing this. They indicated it was a little cliff next to a farm field north of town. We went out and had a look, and my gosh, you know, this cliff sticks up about 12 meters. Solid Sinter, unlike anything I had ever seen before. You know, absolutely enormous Sinter terrace. Basically a fossil hot spring pool. Okay, so fast forward, we did a lot of geophysical work. We did a lot of geochemical work and identified areas that we thought would be the feeder zone below the Sinter. And we've now drilled eight, widely spaced holes over about 1 kilometer strike. The northernmost hole is actually, I think, 400 meters from the coast. Okay, it's right next to the ocean. So we drilled these holes with the intention of identifying, hopefully tagging, your odds of hitting a high-grade vein in an epithermal system are maybe 1 out of 10, okay? But we managed to snag veins in seven out of the 8 holes.
Wow.
And, appreciable grades, too. We're starting to learn more about the system. We can see a fairly extensive vein network emerging at depth. We've done some recent geophysical work that's enhanced that now. So we've done what's called CSAMT. It's an acronym that's a big mouthful, but it's Controlled Source Audiomagnetotellurics. Okay, and we did this survey actually while we were drilling. So the drill holes were not oriented on this survey, but the survey has now highlighted this hydrothermal system. We can basically see the plumbing almost like you can see bones in an X-ray. Okay, so it's really interesting because most of the holes that do have a decent vein intercept are actually intersected what we call the resistivity anomaly. It's a near vertical feature that projects down into the ground for quite some distance. And what we think is going on is that we are still in the near surface environment. Basically we're kind of at the top of the system. But, there's at least some indication, holes 1, 4, and 5, which there's a cross-section in the news release, show that there's a vein that projects straight down into the ground. We've already tagged it over 300 vertical meters, and it's heading straight down to the prospective boiling horizon where we think the thing could go, become much higher grade. So, very exciting story. We're going to have to do some deep drilling. We'll start that after the first of the year. We moved what we call PQ diameter drill pipes and equipment over that will allow us to drill deeper holes and give that deeper, potentially high-grade target a fair test. But I guess what strikes me is that the gold comes all the way to surface. Mm-hmm. You think about this system, these things are kind of like, they're not like a pressure cooker in a way. The hot water in the ground is bubbling away, boiling away, building up steam, and every once in a while, these things just cut loose. And down deep in the ground somewhere, when the things cut loose, we call it flashing. They basically, it's like a giant burp out of the ground. And as the fluids come rushing out of the ground, all this wonderful gold and silver starts precipitating. And lo and behold, in this system, it looks like a lot of that gold and silver actually made it all the way to surface, which is very encouraging.
Oh, I see. So I'm just looking at some of these values. They have a pretty high silver content there as well, I believe. And, you know, looking at something like, a meter and a half of 5.3 gold equivalent ounces, grams per ton gold equivalent. But then there's some extremely high-grade things, too. A third of a meter at 135 grams per ton gold equivalent.
Yes.
So I guess I bet what you're saying here is that you're seeing the surface. You're expecting something that's mineable to be quite a bit deeper. I mean, these are probably pretty narrow veins, and they're vertically orientated pretty much, I guess, right?
Yeah, they are, but these are also potentially economic. But I think they're leading us down. Like I said, this thing literally just flashed or cut loose. It burped a couple of times. One episode appears to be reasonably gold rich. The other episode is silver rich. You know why? I don't know. But these things are leading us down deeper into the ground, and you know, with a little luck, we're going to find something very high grade at depth.
So what you're? Do you have any idea yet if this is? If you have the right kind of values at depth, would this be probably, how would you get down to there? Do you speculate that you'd be going with a shaft, or could there be some sort of a ramping into it?
Yeah.
Or is that just too early to speculate?
It's a bit early to speculate, but most mines now use ramps to access, especially in the depths we're talking about. We're not talking about a kilometer deep. We're talking about a few hundred meters, 300-400 meters.
Uh-huh.
So usually you would access something like that with a ramp, no problem. Yeah.
Do you expect there might be some nuggeting issues here? Because I'm looking at these values, and you have these incredibly high values, Nugget follows you everywhere.
No, this is not a nuggety gold system, Jay.
Okay.
This is what we'll call a well-behaved, fire assayable type of metal system. It's not nuggety like what we have in Australia. I love nugget, don't get me wrong, but this is a predictable thing. It's a little bit easier to reconcile.
That's a good thing. And metallurgy, have any idea about that? Because I think you have.
That's a wonderful aspect of these things. Look, the whole business strategy we have is to find high silica veins that have gold and silver. Okay, because that eliminates the need to build a mill. Okay, in Japan, the way you treat this, you mine it, you ship it to a smelter. They actually use it for smelter flux. You get paid a significant percentage, say plus 90% of the value of the gold and silver. Even get paid for the silica content. Okay, and you do not have to build a mill. That's how they mine at Hishikari. That's how they have traditionally mined in Japan. They mine the high grade veins and used it as smelter flux.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great, and you don't have to then build a mill, which would be a very expensive proposition, I suppose. So, I should mention to our listeners that you have a couple of pretty prestigious strategic investors as well. I think Newmont and Sumitomo, right?
Correct. Newmont and Sumitomo Corporation, and historically, those two companies worked together for a very long time.
And what sort of percentage of this very small number of shares out are in the public float or owned by retail investors, less?
Yeah, so there's about, 48 or something million shares out at the moment. Newmont holds about 7 or 8%. Eric Sprott holds about 10.
Uh-huh.
Management and insiders, control around 20. So, it's very tightly held. Newmont does have the right to tip in two more tranches of money. I suspect they'll probably do that, based on the encouragement we're seeing. It's a unique company. We're focused on a very strategic business model in a new jurisdiction, but it's also well-structured, and we've got the right partner.
Sure do. Just one last question before I let you go. What news events. Will there be more drill holes coming out anytime soon?
Yes, and that's the other part of the news release. Okay, we're drilling at Omui mine site, which is about 10 kilometers south of Omui Center. Omui, there's actual veins sticking out of the ground. We are drilling some shallow holes. We're also drilling some deeper holes, testing CSAMT targets. We're in hole number 9 right now. We finished hole 8 the other day. We have seen a number of veins in the holes to date, and we've also seen some, you know, electrum and silver sulfur salts in one, you know, in some of the veins, and one in particular is about 1.6 meters wide. So I would expect good news out of the holes from Omui. And then next year, early next year, we'll fire up drilling again at Omui Center. We'll go back and retest this area, hopefully test that deep high-grade potential.
And are we looking at a similar kind of a target here, this other one you're talking
yes.
about?
Yes. All of these
center?
Are, yes, they're all high-grade epithermal veins. And what's really exciting about Omui is the high grade that we see is actually very near surface. So when I talked about the system burping, you know, at Omui mm-hmm. Center, same thing happened at Omui. So we actually see little particles and pieces of very gold-rich and silver-rich vein material that's been flushed up, you know, little fragments and stuff that's been flushed up into the near-surface environment. So we know there's something happening at depth.
Mm. Wow, very exciting. Well, obviously, the market is... Somebody's paying attention with the stock up now. I see 37 cents in U.S. money. That's up 21.38% on the day. So obviously people are paying attention. Thank you very much, Quentin, for being with us. And I guess we're going to have you on in a couple of weeks, hopefully to talk about Novo as well. So we're really looking forward to that. But thanks so much again for being with us. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Sure thing. We'll have good news for people in a couple of weeks around Novo or between now and the next time we talk.
Excellent. Can't wait. Okay, thank you very much. Well, folks, we do have to go to commercial break, but don't go away because Alistair McLeod will be with us. Some very important things to talk about. And Alistair always helps us understand not that something is going to happen, but why he believes it will happen. So I hope you'll stick around and listen to what Alistair McLeod has right after the break. Don't go away.
Great Bear Resources, trading under GBR on the TSX and GTBDF on the OTCQB, is a gold exploration company focused on their wholly owned Dixie Project in the prolific Red Lake Mining District of Canada. Having recently made 4 major gold discoveries, GBR is now fully funded to drill 90,000 meters through to the year 2020 as part of a very active exploration program. Rob McEwen of McEwen Mining, a Red Lake veteran, is a significant shareholder following a recent $5.7 million investment. To stay up to date, visit greatbearresources.ca.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to have with me once again one of our more regular guests, Alistair McLeod. And so most of you know him as an ex-stockbroker, an ex-banker, and as an economist. He writes for Gold Money. He is a senior fellow there and head of research at Gold Money. And he writes a brilliant weekly commentary that I think is a must-read if you really care to know or to try to understand the reasons why markets are likely headed in the direction they are. Not just, you know, you can say some people are satisfied enough to know which direction the markets are going and they don't want to know anything more. But those of us who really try to understand and want try to figure out if someone is full of baloney or not, want to know the reasons for it and understand it. And Alistair walks you through, I think, deeply into the reasons why things are happening and not just the fact that they are happening. So that's why I'm always so pleased to have him with us. Thanks for joining me again, Alistair.
That's very much my pleasure, Jay.
It's always good to have you. And I want to talk to you today about an article you wrote on October 10th. This is primarily what I want to focus on, if we can. Monetary failure is becoming inevitable. And I'd like to just read the first couple of paragraphs of the introduction because I think that really lays the groundwork, the framework for the article itself. And I quote, an unpleasant conjunction of events is beginning to undermine government finances in the more developed nations, including the arrival of a long-term trend of rising welfare commitments with an increasing certainty of a global-scale credit crisis. Those problems are, in turn, the outcome of a combination of the peak of the credit cycle and increasing trade protectionism. Few observers seem aware that an economic and systemic crisis will occur at the same time as government finances are already precarious. However, the consequences are unthinkable for the authorities, and for this reason, it is certain such a downturn will lead to a substantial increase in monetary inflation. End of quote. Well, you started out your October 10th article stating that, as I just read, an unpleasant conjunction of events is beginning to undermine government finances in more developed nations. Perhaps you could just talk a little bit about what those events are.
Yes, certainly, Jay. I'm sure your listeners have heard me bang on about the credit cycle and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is coming to fruition. But there is another aspect of government finances which hasn't been hitting the headlines recently, and that is the increasing cost of government welfare. And you may remember back in 2012 that an economist called Lawrence Kotlikoff estimated the net present value of U.S. government welfare liabilities to be in the order of $220 trillion. Yeah. He was admittedly the highest forecast, if you like, of that. I mean, but there were others saying it's going to be $100 trillion or $80 trillion or whatever. The key to this is to understand that these welfare commitments are now beginning to hit government finances, not just mm-hmm. in America, but particularly in Europe and also in the UK. Now, the UK government has actually, for the last, I suppose, 15 years or so, started to try and address this by raising the age at which pension entitlement kicks in. This is for the state pension. Mm-hmm. In America, you've got some huge potential costs on the health system, as indeed we all have. It's not just America. Now, with these costs coming due, when you see that this welfare bill is now rising and accelerating, and at the same time we have a credit crisis in the offing, I mean, if you want a visible sign that this is developing, just look at what's happening with the German banks, the major banks. And I think if you looked at that, you would be convinced that there is something nasty, if you like, in the credit cycle likely to happen. If you put together those two things, a credit cycle which is turning sour, and that would inevitably lead to a weaker economy, both for America and also for other nations, and these welfare commitments rising, you can see that very rapidly government finances are going to get into a very, very deep water. And that was really the thrust of the article. It was the conjunction of these two things coming together like two icebergs, mm-hmm. you know, sort of about to crash into each other. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're probably sitting in a boat sort of watching one coming from one side, another iceberg coming from another side, and guess who's going to get crushed, you know? Can we row out of the way quick enough?
The icebergs have a way of surviving.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and so you have the credit cycle, which suggests that you know, if you have a credit cycle, anything halfway as severe as we had in 2008, 2009, some people, I think, probably including yourself, think it could be a lot worse this time, given the dynamics, given all the debt and all of the well, we've never solved anything in the past. We've only just layered it on. So you have the credit cycle, which suggests decreasing earnings or decreasing revenues for government, decreasing tax revenues at the same time that you have this dramatic increase in expenditures by government for the welfare state. I suppose some of that has to do with the aging population and the younger reducing number of younger people producing and paying into it. That's certainly what the Western world seems to have, is the aging of their population, right?
Yes, that certainly doesn't help. But I think by far the most important thing is, I mean, you know, we accept demographics, and indeed that is that must be part of any economist's forecast, the net present value of those future liabilities. But I think the real problem is that those costs are now sort of beginning to come through. And the problem with the credit cycle is that the dynamics behind it are far greater than the dynamics behind the Lehman crisis back in 2008. And on top of that, we've got a touch of the Smoot-Hawleys. Now, Smoot-Hawley was the Tariff Act, which was passed by Congress on the 31st of October, 1929. And that was the month when Wall Street crashed. It could see this one coming. And so, you know, and nobody's really researched this, but it looks to me, every way I look at it, there is a synergistic effect, if you like, where one and one equals three, where you combine the credit cycle, which peaked in 1929, with a jacking up of tariffs and trade protectionism, and you're going to collapse the economy. I mean, it's really as simple as that. And I'm afraid that the comparison with 1929 to 1932 is really quite alarming. And on top of that, you've got a welfare state, a costly welfare state, which is considerably more expensive than any welfare payments that were paid out in 1929 to 1930. So you can see that there's a conjunction of events here which we haven't seen before. Now, we just hope we can navigate our way through it, but I would be rather skeptical about attempts to do that being successful. I mean, you know, the first thing that is likely to happen is that a bank will get into trouble. Now, the reason I focus on Germany is really twofold. Firstly, we know that the major banks, and particularly Deutsche Bank and Commerzbank, you've just got to look at their share price, and they've got problems. We also know that the German economy is tipping rapidly into recession because their major customer is China, and China is not buying autos anymore. So the German economy is tipping into recession. Now, we do know, therefore, that these banks are going to have an increase in non-performing loans. They're going to have sort of other problems related with their commercial lending. And, you know, and this is after or on top of all the problems that Deutsche Bank and Commerzbank have had, which has driven their share prices down to a tenth of their highs. So you can see that it's quite a nasty situation there. And if confidence starts being eroded in the banking sector in the Eurozone, it's not just the German banks. I mean, there are quite a few others. Now, having said that, I don't actually think that Deutsche Bank will just go bust and all depositors will sort of face getting nothing. What I do see is it will be rescued. It will be nationalized, or it'll be supported by the German government or something. But you know, this is a rolling situation. And in another article, I compared it with the Credit Anstalt crisis in 1932, I think it was. Now that was Credit Anstalt had been put together out of a number of bust banks or failing banks, and eventually it failed as well. So if you look at the Deutsche Bank example, Deutsche Bank and Commerzbank, you know, perhaps they may be sort of merged into a super bank with a certain amount of government money chucked in it, but then it'll fail again. This is the problem. And you know, in 1932 we had Credit Anstalt in Austria, which is a relatively small country in Europe. This time Germany is a far more serious matter. So you know, in the sense that there is room for dropping the ball through this credit crisis, I think we should be really quite wary of having money in banks, if you like, in the more general sense.
Yeah, for sure. People don't realize that they're really unsecured creditors to the banks, and it's not really their money once they put it there.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, you know, I think the article that you're referring to is your September 27th article, and people can go there at goldmoney.com and read it. The Ghost of Failed Banks Returns, I think that's the article you're referring to. Do you, do you, recently there's been some, you know, some unrest in the repo market, in the U.S. Treasury repo market. Do you You think those are perhaps some tremors of what you're talking about?
Yes, I do. I've got a little anecdote. We had a bank in this country called Northern Rock. And I think it was in December 2007. I happened to be sitting in the offices of one of the large money brokers in London. And I was suddenly told by the dealers that the interbank market had seized up. And nobody really knew why. And I sort of thought, well, you know, to me, this was actually a very serious thing because as a follower of Austrian economics, understanding banks, understanding banking cycles and all the rest of it, when you get the liquidity in the market, in the wholesale money market, effectively disappearing, this is a very serious issue. 2 months later, yes, it was 2 months later, it was in February 2008, Northern Rock appealed to the government to be rescued, and it had to be taken over by the government. That was 2 months from that point. Now, you can't definitely say the reason that the interbank market seized up was because Northern Rock was going bust. No, but you can see that the situation is an interesting coincidence. Let's put it that way. This time, we have another coincidence, we have the repo market failing. Now, the repo market is a lot bigger than the interbank market in London, because the interbank market in London is an unsecured liquidity market. You don't have to put up any collateral. Basically, you have credit lines with all the major banks you're likely to deal with in the LIBOR market. In the case of the repo, this is the numbers are far, far bigger. Now, it so happened that the day the repo rate shot up to 10% was the day when Deutsche Bank formally sold, it completed its sale of its prime brokership to BNP. Now, you can imagine, or you can, well, I can imagine that under those circumstances, you know, the deposits which are held on Deutsche Bank's prime brokerage business, and these would be other banks, it would be hedge funds, whatever, you know, they may not actually travel with the business being sold. So you can have a situation where someone is left, you know, without any funds, and they need to cover. And I think that, you know, the coincidence of the events, I think, is interesting. But going back to the Northern Rock thing, you know, I just see a seizing in the up of the markets, in the wholesale money markets, and, you know, you count 1, 2, 3 months, whatever, and you got a problem. And that's what happened last time, and that, I think, could well happen again.
Alistair, why do you think so few people see this? I mean, you, in to quote your opening remarks in this article, few observers seem aware that an economic and systemic crisis will occur at the same time as government finances are already precarious. Well, I mean, the things you're talking about, they're not particularly new. Why do you think people can't put two and two together on this?
I think it's vested interest. I mean, if you know, if you're an investment manager, then basically your livelihood depends on you being bullish. So dare you think of anything else? No. And I think if you're an ordinary person, you just go about your day-to-day life. You don't, you know, you don't necessarily, you know, think about these things too much. You don't want to address something which is likely to be a problem. You don't want to sort of anticipate something nasty. Very, very few people do that. Most people go through life sort of happy-go-lucky. I mean, you know, look at the number of people, 78%, I think was the last number I saw in the United States, of people on salaries live paycheck to paycheck. You know, hold on a minute. Is that, so, you know, are those people actually thinking something might go wrong? No, they're not. And I really think that you've got this sort of human nature, particularly when governments basically rescue everything. You know, we're never going to have a problem because the government says so. The government will sort it out. No, they won't.
Ultimately, they won't. They seem to paper things over for a while. And so, yeah, and I guess you wouldn't if you were, say, working for J.P. Morgan or somebody, go on CNBC and start talking in negative terms, because it could actually start to trigger things too. So you know, you don't want to be the one that starts the avalanche from going down the mountainside.
Good heavens, no! I mean, can you imagine?
So, Alistair, here's the thing. Now, you know, as you say, this is going to come as a shock to the authorities. And how will they respond? I mean, we can probably judge that they'll respond. The central banks will start printing money like mad again, right? And then what happens to interest rates? Do we keep seeing interest rates plummet, go down lower and lower, at least for the start?
There is a, if you like, there obviously is a conflict here because as the rate of money printing ramps up, we would expect the purchasing power of the fiat currency to diminish. Right. Now, under those circumstances, interest rates should rise. Mm-hmm. So I think what you'll have is you'll have central banks with a real problem. The market will be demanding higher rates. In other words, the government won't be able to fund itself at the rates I just had an interruption here. The government won't be able to fund itself at anything like the rates which the Fed is trying to force on the markets. Then you'll have an unfunded situation, which then reverberates into the foreign exchange markets. So you can see that a government crisis in funding could arise very, very rapidly by the necessity to bond yields down so the government can fund itself.
Yeah, and what you've talked about recently with respect to the world's reserve currency, the dollar, at some point in time, as rates decline, the dollar becomes something people don't really, it seems as though it's likely that people won't want it. You talked about the normal interest rates or the time preference rates, as you put it, that gold has a 1.5 to 2% preference rate, and everything, as you pointed out, commodities have a preference rate. Do you see the possibility then of a dollar that is no longer in favor as the world's reserve currency, thereby leading to the destruction of the world's reserve currency, and as measured in that currency, commodities rising very dramatically, we might have an inflationary problem?
Yes, I think that's almost certainly going to happen. Quite how we get there is something which is a matter of debate. Yeah. But bear in mind that the U.S. budget deficit has been financed almost totally by foreign purchases of dollars. Now, with global trade contracting, there is no need for foreigners to buy more dollars. If anything, they are overweight dollars. And the interesting thing is that this is a point that Mark Carney was making at his Jackson Hole speech when he was saying that too much money from emerging market economies is tied up in dollars. You know, they should be released so that in investment, if you like, can continue. Now, he actually said that at Jackson Hole. I thought that was quite brave, but but it does highlight a problem, and that is that the world is one way or another moving on from the dollar being the reserve currency. We don't know how quickly it'll happen, but mm-hmm. at this time, the government borrowing requirements are likely to escalate. This is not good news.
Uh-huh. No, and where is the money going to come from to finance that if foreign credit isn't forthcoming anymore? The Chinese and others, the Japanese too, for their own reasons, don't have endless resources to keep buying and financing U.S. living beyond its means. The scale of the problem is to be grasped, you talked about, with just a minute or two left here. What is this going to mean? And, the timing is impossible to know. This idea of the world's reserve currency. I mean, everybody that I talk to, people, that financial people say, well, Taylor, you're just smoking something funny because there's no way any other currency has the liquidity to go to as a world's reserve currency. What do you say to people that say that?
Well, they're making a statement of the obvious, and this is the real problem, I think, that central bankers have. You know, they're hooked on the dollar, and they don't really know what the replacement is. Yeah. I mean, you've got three blocks, really, haven't you? You've got the dollar, you've got the euro, and you've got the yuan. Now, if the dollar's going down the tubes, then either the euro or the yuan has got to take over. And do we want either of those?
I don't think so.
You know, it's quite a problem, isn't it? So I can see that there's going to, I mean, in terms of the geopolitics of finance, I think is another issue which is rapidly coming up and could be a major problem. Now, after the next credit crisis, then this is really going to come into focus.
Okay, 30 seconds. Short-term interest rates heading down, lower.
Short-term, yes, manipulated down, yeah.
And so the equity market could remain strong for a little while longer. It should be good for treasuries and for gold in the short term.
Yeah, basically, I'm not too sure that it would be good for yields. I mean, I think the Fed can sit on interest rates at this level, maybe even bring them down a notch in December sort of thing. But I think that markets have really discounted this game, I think, quite a long way now. And I think if we get more evidence that the economy is tanking, then I think that will probably start driving equities.
All right. We'll have to leave it go at that. Thank you so much, Alistair, for being with us. Always a pleasure having you. Always interesting, stimulating discussion when you're with us. So I thank you very much and look forward to doing it again sometime very soon. So thank you very much again.
Thank you, Jay.
All righty, folks. So that is all we have for this week, all the time we have. And next week, my guest will be Nick Appleyard of TriStar. John Rubino will be with me and my friend Eric Coffin. As well. And so until next Tuesday, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.